Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today, I'm joined by Anne Birchfield, who set the women's supported FKT on the 112-mile-long Bartram Trail in one day, 19 hours, and 42 minutes. Anne, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
All right, and thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat with you about the Bartram Trail, which is a trail I've done, not as an FKT, but yeah, I don't think it's super commonly known. So I'd love it if you could start out by telling our listeners about the Bartram Trail, like where it is, what it is. Just give us a little bit of a description of it.
Yeah, so this is a trail that is, I think it's about 112 miles long. And starting from the north, it begins at Cheewabald, which is actually a spot that's on the AT in North Carolina. And then it sort of continues south from there over pretty mountainous terrain. It crosses the AT again around Wyobald. And then it continues south into Georgia. And sort of as you get further south, it kind of heads down toward the Chattooga River, and it slowly becomes a little bit of more flatter rolling terrain. You're following the river, and then it continues on right about to the Georgia-South Carolina border where it ends. And another sort of interesting thing about this trail is that the terrain really is pretty varied. You have some pretty big climbs and rocky, rough terrain in the northern part. And then right around the midpoint of the trail, you actually have a fairly extended road section that's been shortened somewhat recently. They've rerouted some parts to make more of it trails and bike path. But there's a good 17 miles, I think, about in the middle where you go down, you're running on country roads, you go straight through the middle of downtown Franklin, North Carolina. And you now, recently, it's been routed to go along the Greenway there, sort of along bike paths. And then you eventually come out and then have some more big climbs as you head back into the trail sections of it. So it's a really interesting, varied trail. It's got big climbs. It's got overlooks. It's got waterfalls. It's got river sections. You go right through a town as well. So it's really quite an interesting trail. And it's one I hadn't been aware of either until I moved to the area. I actually live in Northeast Georgia in a very small town called Mount Airy, but it's about 40, 45 minutes from Clayton, which is right near some of the southern sections of the Bartram Trail. So I became aware of it when I just went out there for a casual day hike. I looked up, oh, here's a hike that goes past a couple of nice waterfalls. I'm going to go look at this. I had a short hike there, but then saw some signage talking about the Bartram Trail. And I realized, oh, this trail keeps going. This is actually a 100-mile-plus trail. And so then, you know, I think probably this is probably about 2021 when I had moved to this area, I became aware of it. And I think that sort of planted this. It would be really fun to do this whole trail someday. And then, you know, gradually, as the next couple of years passed, you know, eventually this year became the year where I realized, okay, I think I've got the time to do this and to train for it. And when I kind of looked and researched a little bit, I thought, you know, maybe the FKT for this would be within reach, and decided it would be a really exciting project to try.
Did you choose to go southbound because of that? You wanted to have the harder stuff first and finish with the easier aspects? Was that why you chose southbound, or did you want to do it because you were more like running home? Why did you choose southbound?
I think there were a couple of reasons. I mean, definitely getting some of the more difficult terrain done early was a consideration. Also, more specifically, you're starting so much higher up. It's actually quite a substantial difference in the total amount of climbing you have to do. And I am definitely someone who, as a hiker and a runner, I love the downhills. I feel more comfortable on the downhills. I mean, climbing a big mountain is fun too, but the idea of being able to do a run that long as a pretty significant net downhill felt, I mean, both from a perspective of trying to get a faster time and also just from a perspective of enjoyment, I thought seemed fun. And then it also was, I mean, there is a little bit of a feeling of you're running home. It definitely ends much closer to home than it starts. So there is something kind of fun about like starting a run at some pretty distant point and you're running back towards your home. That was also, I think all of those kind of went into that. And it was, you know, the logistics actually of doing it southbound, it has a lot of advantages and does most of the FKTs and attempts I've seen seem to do it that direction because of the net downhill and the harder terrain. But there is the problem that Chihuahua Bald is a pretty substantial hike in. It's a, I think it's, you know, from the direction I did, it's something like a 5 mile hike up from the road and up a big steep climb too.
Yeah.
So, you know, hiking in casually, I think it was, you know, something like 3 to 3.5 hours just to get to the starting point.
Right.
And I definitely found myself thinking, okay, I've got to figure out how I'm going to do it from this direction and deal with having that much of a big hike at the very start.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was questioning my life choices finishing north. I went northbound, finishing with that gigantic climb and then getting to the top and like, now I have to hike out. So how did you approach that? Did you have somebody coming in with you, setting up a camp? How did you approach leaving the summit of this giant mountain as rested as possible?
Yeah, so what I did end up deciding to do was to camp out the night before, to actually start the evening before I was going to do the FKT attempt. And I had, very kindly, my pacer offered to hike up with me and camp up there so that he could help carry the gear down in the morning. So we hiked up and camped and just had really tried to have the most relaxing night we could, you know, took a leisurely as we could hike up, set things up, and then just kind of tried to turn in early in my tent. And even if it wasn't the very most restful sleep because there was a lot of anticipation of the next day, it was still a very peaceful way to start, like really to relax and sort of relax that whole evening and wake up and be right at my starting point. Because often when I've done a big run or a race, you know, often you have these really early starts, either for logistics reasons or because it's when a race is scheduled. And so like you're setting an alarm clock really early, you're not super well rested the night before. And, you know, I mean, it's fine. That's part of doing it. But with an experience like this where I could plan the logistics myself, I was really glad to be able to take the opportunity to have it be starting rested, starting relaxed, especially knowing that I then was probably going to be going through two or most of two nights without sleep, wanting to be as rested as I could going into it.
Did you end up sleeping or taking any sort of dirt nap during the FKT?
I did zero sleep. I did no sleep at all, which when I've done things this long, that's usually been how I've approached it. I always approach with the idea of if I really, really need a nap, I'll find a way to take it. But I've typically found that when I have the momentum going and the adrenaline, I'm moving, I don't want to stop and nap, that it feels better to just carry that momentum and keep going. I mean, I think if I was going much more than that, you know, 44, 45 hours, as you get towards 48 hours, you probably start to reach a point where eventually you're going to need it. But going up to about that point, the like 1 to 2 nights, I found that for me personally, I prefer to just kind of push through and keep the momentum going. And I've actually never during a long race or something like this, taken a nap or a dirt nap.
Yeah, in that case, it definitely makes a lot of sense to get that hike over with and not add that on to your sleeplessness.
Yeah.
So you were supported on this effort. You mentioned one of your pacers came up and hiked your gear out. So can you talk a little bit about your crew and or pacers? How often you were seeing people, if you were by yourself, you had pacers with you? How did that whole aspect play out?
I definitely had some logistical challenges in just arranging everything, and especially because in the current location where I'm living and the current season I am in my life, I'm not living right where I have a whole bunch of running friends right nearby. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm in, you know, in a pretty rural area, and then also am a full-time parent to a 2-year-old. So
that's an adventure in and of itself.
Yeah. So, you know, so definitely it was a case of, you know, I was kind of thinking, you know, in previous places, like, I mean, back when I was living in the Melbourne area in Australia, I had a running group and lots of running friends who, if I was doing something like this, there'd be a whole wide network of people I'd call and there'd be a bunch of people I'd know who could come and pace and help me out with things. But here I was sort of realizing, like, you know, I have a few people who I know that I've seen in races, but who live pretty far away and that I didn't know super well. And then other than that, I was like, well, you know, I have a mom's hiking group. And I had, you know, some people that I've known through, you know, various trail endeavors around here, but not really specifically trail runners. And then I also had my family and people I knew from my book club, too. So I actually had several people crewing me who had never crewed something like this before, who just said, OK, you know, I'm really excited to be part of this. Tell me what to do. I'll come help out. But I had, I would say most of my crew, I think, other than my dad, who had crewed me when I ran UTMB back in 2019, I think everyone else had never crewed before.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Other than, I guess my pacer had been, he had been involved in some things before, and he was actually someone who I met through a mutual friend. So I had a friend in my hiking group who had been very involved with the Georgia Appalachian Trail Club. And so she, you know, wasn't able to personally help me out that weekend due to other obligations, but she said, you know, I'll talk to my friends and see if I can find someone. So she actually introduced me to someone who offered to come and pace and, I mean, really helped a ton, who I had never met prior to this. You know, we just exchanged some emails, had a few phone calls, decided this sounded like a good time to both of us.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so it was really, I mean, it was amazing to see the people around me, even people, many of whom weren't trail runners, come together and really try to help me make this happen.
I have to wonder, with people who are inexperienced at crewing and people who are new to you, does that lead to any issues, like with meeting up with people or missing anyone? Did it all work out well?
It all worked out well. There was, and I would say this was actually not due to inexperience on any crew's part, was actually due partially to a technical issue and some weird trail math on my end. Also, there was one stop where I missed my crew because I came through faster than expected. When I think I had some mileages possibly in the spreadsheet that I'd given everyone, where I think a couple miles in one section I'd kind of given to the later section and how I was calculating it. So I sort of arrived later than expected at one stop and then a little bit earlier based off of that timing than expected at the next one. And sort of coinciding with that, I had the battery run out on my InReach tracker. So people didn't know exactly where I was right then. So there was one stop when I was heading up towards Raven Bald, which was, that's a little over 50K from the end. I could tell I was flying after a really slow night, and I got to the stop and didn't see my crew. And I thought, you know what, I've got to just keep going up the mountain. I'm going to send everyone a quick text letting them know I'm fine. I can filter some water. I've got enough snacks in my bag. And I think I must have just missed them. Like, I think I was walking up the mountain and I think I later heard their voices down there, but we didn't quite hear each other, didn't quite connect. And at that point, there was no way I was going to backtrack. I was, I was like, I'm getting close to 50K from the end. I'm feeling like I'm on a mission. There's no way I'm going to walk back down that hill. So I just texted everyone and let them know and then met them at the next part. And I think it was a little bit longer than expected than getting down from Raven Bald. So there was a little bit of, you know, I think my dad maybe started to get a little worried, like, is this taking a little longer than expected? It's kind of getting towards dark on the second day, and they didn't have the tracker to fall back on. But I, you know, I'd managed to send out one or two messages. So that was the only place where, you know, the logistics kind of made it tricky. But really that, you know, that was really not something that was due to the crew. I think that was really kind of a technical issue. And I'd say more of that was on my end. Mostly, like, it worked great. Like, I sort of, you know, like, I basically made drop bags. So, like, I had bags with the snacks and my sunscreen and things I knew I'd want at particular times and gave it to people and, you know, showed them on a map where to be, gave them a range of times, sort of explained what the range was, gave people a link for the tracker. And, like, my crew, they really came through. It was really amazing to, you know, to, like, see friends from my everyday life being willing to show up and help me do something like this. I had I had a couple of crew actually like around midnight when I finished the climb down from Wyobald and started the road section. They were waiting there for me with coffee and ramen, and they made a big sign to cheer me on with.
Oh, nice.
Which, yeah, that's like, I've always, I don't know, when I've done races or events, I've sometimes seen signs up for other runners. And right, it's something I've like never thought, you know, you never ask someone to make you a sign, but it always, right, like, oh, that seems like such a nice thing. And then to just come down and see like this sign say, you know, go in, we believe in you.
Right.
That's like a really, it's like a really spirit lifting thing to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Every runner needs a sign making friend.
Yes.
Like that's their love language.
Yeah.
It does. It makes a huge difference for mm-hmm. sure. So obviously, like when you missed this crew stop, you're by yourself. Were you by yourself most of the time? I mean, obviously you had some pacers.
Yeah. So I had one pacer and he ran with me. We sort of strategically did it so that for all of the trail sections at night, pretty much, I would have a pacer. But then on the road sections, I had, rather than having a pacer run with me, I had crew in their cars. So the people who had met me there with the sign, they actually sort of followed me in their vehicle as I ran into downtown Franklin. And then I ran the Greenway section. And then getting from Franklin to Hickory Knoll, that I think it's maybe 7 miles or something, I had my father following me with a car. So I sort of had vehicle pacers for part of it, which was something I'd never experienced before.
Right.
And yeah, then the second day, for most of the daytime chunk, I was on my own. And the whole first day up until right around sunset, I was on my own. But then overnight, so running down from Wyobald, I had my pacer with me for that section. And then he kind of got to take a break while I ran the road section. And then when I then started the long climb up from Hickory Knoll, he rejoined me. So sort of for that night section and then going into the morning of the second day. Mm-hmm. And sort of then again, he got to take a little bit of a break and then rejoined me for about the last 20 miles.
Okay.
Then that second night.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Did you have any navigational challenges on this trail?
Yeah. So I would say for the most part, the trail is very well marked. The only places that I found challenging were when you're not completely on trail and you start to see roads or you kind of cross into civilization. So there were a couple parts where in some of the earlier sections, you're sort of on some dirt back roads. And some of those, there are like a few intersections and sometimes you're not sure which way's the trail, which way's a driveway. Mm-hmm. And you can figure out pretty quick, especially, you know, if you get out a GPX map on your phone, it's not hard to tell, but you can sometimes lose a few minutes here and there just trying to make sure, okay, do I turn here? Do I not turn here? Because it's mostly marked, but like occasionally when there's a lot of dirt roads, there's not super prominent marking at every spot. And then the only place where I really felt turned around was when you getting off the Greenway section in Franklin, as you kind of come out of there. And there's some places where you kind of are going through sort of like a grassy park area and along a river, and you kind of and then you go through a couple of parking lots to kind of get to then the place where you re-meet the actual road. There was definitely a spot there where I got a little bit turned around. I mean, again, it wasn't really a major issue. Like if you were to look at it on the map, it's like a very small spot of me walking around in circles for it really probably couldn't have been more than 5 or maybe 10 minutes. That can feel like an eternity when it's the middle of night and I don't even know how many miles in at that point, maybe probably, you know, close to 50 miles in, somewhere around 50 plus miles in. You're like, oh no, am I going to lose all of my time right here walking around in circles trying to get to this right spot in the park? But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the navigation issues were not major. And mm-hmm. for all of the trail sections, it's very easy to tell where you're going and super well.
Right.
I actually find that it's when you're in civilization, the navigation can be more difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, adding that to nighttime.
Yeah.
At night, like, maybe there is a sign on the other side of that parking lot, but you can't see it in the dark.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and it was at nighttime that section happened. I think mm-hmm. I had practiced that section, but I had practiced it in daylight.
Right.
So,
yeah, that makes sense. Can you talk a little bit about what you were carrying with you, what your gear was, your nutrition? Mm-hmm. You mentioned having a water filter. So what were you carrying with you?
Yeah, so I carried with me, I guess I had sort of, you know, like the basic set of stuff that I'd normally carry with me if I'm going to be out in the woods for a while. I kept the amount of water not huge. Like I had a water filter as a backup since I knew this trail, you pretty frequently pass water sources. So I sort of knew if I run out, you know, I can stop and filter and did end up using that once. And you know, then I have, you know, a few of your emergency backup things like a space blanket, a rain jacket, which I didn't really end up needing. Actually, because the weather conditions were cooler than I was expecting, you know, I was thinking, man, I'm going to be hot. I'm going to be thinking about how much water do I need to carry and having people dumping ice on me. But instead, I was dealing with weather that was much cooler than expected for that time of year. At night, temperatures were down in the 30s.
Oh, wow.
Which was really, yeah, really surprising for late May.
Mm-hmm.
It was not what we were expecting at all. So that meant I actually was carrying, you know, I did want to have my rain jacket in there. And I did have, you know, a long sleeve top and even a fleece in my bag, which I did have to get out and put those on, like gloves and a beanie. So like I actually mm-hmm. had some cool weather gear in there. And then I sort of tried to just keep a stock of easy to carry snacks on me. So I had, you know, so like I had goo gels and Stroop waffles. I had some Little Debbie oatmeal cream pies. I had fruit snacks. And I sort of try to have some Reese's peanut butter cups. And so I try to have a couple of those things in my pack at any given time and then sort of replenish them when I met with crew.
Right.
And then, so I mean, other than a little bit of cold weather gear, a little bit of nutrition, some water and a filter, you know, the basic things like having a head torch on me. Those were the main things I carried. One thing that I did end up using when I was on the road, which isn't something I normally think about when running, was I had a high-vis vest for when I was running those country roads at night.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is, that was something I almost probably wouldn't have thought of, except that I've had a few races I've done in Australia where there are road section that's like required gear. And so I thought, oh, you know, that's actually really smart. If you're running on the road, it's good to be really visible.
Right.
So that was one piece of gear that I've wouldn't typically use in a run that I used for this particular situation. And so I had, you know, like sort of like a standard, you know, like kind of one of those Ultimate Direction adventure packs, moderately filled with stuff. But I tried to go, you know, relatively on the light side since I was getting crew, you know, probably, you know, most of the time it was every 10 miles or so. That's sort of about how often you're getting road crossings approximately. Sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less.
I imagine you didn't actually end up having a lot of traffic on the road section.
No, there was almost none because it was the middle of the night and Franklin's not a super busy area.
Yeah, that's actually kind of nice because when I hiked it, I stayed in Franklin. So it was split up. But I remember coming into Franklin, there was actually a decent amount of traffic because I was walking in it.
Yeah.
You know, 5 p.m., quote unquote, rush hour. But like there's a lot of people on the road around, you know, 5, 6 p.m. and there's no shoulder. So
yeah,
I remember not liking that road walk. But the walk out of town the next morning was fine because there was not a lot of people on the road early in the morning. But what about wildlife? Did you see much wildlife out there?
So there was not a ton. There was never any super close to me. I did see one bear from a distance. So as I was climbing up Wyabald, and I was on my own, it was kind of getting a little bit towards evening, starting to actually get surprisingly chilly up there. And I'm hiking up and I just, you know, I see something zip by and I'm like, oh, that's a pretty big animal moving. Is that a deer? And then I was like, oh, that's a pretty dark colored deer. Wait, is that a dog? Oh, no, that's a bear. That's a bear. Okay. And then, you know, sort of by the time I really registered it was a bear, it had already kind of run off up the mountain. But that was kind of cool. You know, hiking in this area, you do see bears once in a while, but I hadn't seen them very often. I think that was the first bear I'd seen this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like a fun little thing to see. Other than that, there was not much. I mean, you know, your usual birds and squirrels and that kind of stuff. But I think that was the only really memorable wildlife that I saw.
I did notice when I did this in the area around the Tatuga, my first night, the friends that were driving me to drop me off, we had a bobcat run in front of our car.
Oh, wow.
And then that night there were coyotes mm-hmm. and owls. It did feel like there was more wildlife on the Bartram than there was on the AT.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I also did it at a very different time of year. So.
What time of year was it?
It was November.
November. Okay. Yeah. So that could be quite different.
Yeah, exactly. So kind of on that track, I didn't see pretty much anybody when I was out there. I'm wondering about your experience. Did you see a lot of people on the trail?
I would say very few on most of it. There were a few sections, because I mean, like in the beginning, I think going up and down Chioa Bald and that whole section really up until Wyobald, I don't think there was maybe near Apple Tree Campground where I had crew meetingly, there was one person who I think might have also been camping there that I saw walking their dog. And they told me, oh, you know, are you the runner? There's someone waiting for you there with their truck right up at the gate. So like I saw one person with their dog then. And then I think up until Wyobald, I don't think I really saw anybody else on the trail. On Wyobald, there were a few, because that was still at the point where there were some, I would say like some through hikers or people on the AT coming through.
Right.
You know, I think I think I saw a few people who looked like they were hiking on the AT up near Wyobald. And then after that, I'm trying to think, there may not have been, I don't know that we saw anybody else.
Yeah.
Maybe was there? There might not have been. I don't remember much of anyone in particular after that. It's kind of amazing actually for a trail as long and really pretty spectacular as it is, it doesn't have a ton of people on it most of the time.
Yeah, that was my experience too. And when I'm researching for our interview, I'm looking and there's very few FKTs on this as well. And
yeah,
I just wondered if you had any thoughts as to why that is. You live in the region and like we said, there's a highly varied trail. It's, you know, goes through a town. Do you have any thoughts on why there aren't as many records or users on this?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like some of it is just that people don't know it's there. I think it's definitely one where if you're not specifically looking for signs and seeking out these kinds of trails, it would be easy to miss. I mean, there's really quite an active organization. The Blue Ridge Bartram Trail Conservancy, I mean, they're doing trail maintenance trips a couple times a month. They have walks out there. There's people using it. Like when I went, you know, during the period of time when I was training, I did go and do one trail maintenance trip out there and it was quite well attended. There were quite a few people who seemed quite familiar with the trail and like they used it pretty often. So there are people using it, but it didn't seem like there's a lot of public knowledge that this trail even exists.
Right.
Even talking to friends I know in the area who hike on some of the other trails around here, when I started to talk about this, you know, and I mentioned the Bartram Trail, I'd say, you know, okay, yeah, that sounds really cool. So where is that?
Right. Yeah.
You know, so even people who live quite close by to it. And I mean, I don't know if some of it is it sort of being very overshadowed by the AT, this sort of in the yeah. same region. So people don't necessarily think of it.
I was wondering, Matt, if this is just its big sister trail that's just over on the next ridge, you mm-hmm. know, and that's why people aren't aware of it. Everybody just goes over there because, yeah, I was surprised at like how few people seem to know about it or what, you know, be on it.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the records, the few that there are. Mm-hmm. You took less than an hour off the previous time.
Yeah.
So how stressful was that for you? Were you aware that you were like cutting it that close? Can you just talk about that?
Yeah. So I definitely was aware. And I think it was a case where, you know, because it was hard to tell for sure exactly how long is this going to take me. I also knew, you know, I think the trail has changed a little bit since that time. The previous record was from, I think it's something like 2012.
Okay.
So, you know, and I was, you know, and I'd been able to run most of the sections and had some guesses, but it can be hard to tell exactly how long you think you're going to take on something like this. And
yeah.
I would say that when I got to Raven Bald and knew that I had so 31 miles and 50K left. And I knew, because I was very much counting the time and thinking about the hours as I was going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sort of knew, okay, I have 14, maybe 14 and a half hours to get this last 50K. I thought, okay, I think I can do that. That felt like at that point, I felt like I'm pretty sure this is going to happen. I had hoped, I would say that, you know, my A goal or my plan had been to take a bit more off of it than that. I would have liked to be closer to the 40-hour range.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say once I got to Raven Bald with those 14 hours, I may have let myself relax a little bit. But also it is just the reality of you find yourself slowing down exponentially when you're doing a really long effort like that. So I, you know, sort of kept an eye on the time. It's like, I know I've got this amount of time left. I think it's going to be okay, but I'm going to keep pushing. And, you know, some sections just went a little bit slower than you were expecting. But I would say that this was more a case of I came down feeling like I had a fairly substantial buffer and like the buffer was sort of slowly decreased. But it never totally felt like, okay, I'm really worried this isn't going to make it. It was sort of like, as I got closer, it sort of felt like, okay, okay, yeah, I think we're going to do it. There were a few points in those last 20 miles where my pacer and I sort of said like, okay, yeah, this is maybe starting to cut it a little close. Let's make sure we push it these next few miles. And we did, and it sort of worked out. So we were very much watching the clock and knew what the timing was. So there were points where I worried about it. I would say a little bit before I got to Ravenbold, when I had that section coming out of the first night and into the second morning, I was starting to think, ooh, I don't know, you know, I'm a little bit behind where I want to be. We'll see how this goes. You know, I've got to just keep pushing forward. And so I had a few sections where I did try to really gun it a little bit and push forward to try to make sure I'd had that time. So it was closer than I had hoped it would be, but it fortunately didn't feel super stressful. I sort of, I would say after I got to Ravenbold, I basically decided, I think I've got this. I just need to not completely stop.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes I think, oh, you know, could I have relaxed less? Could I have pushed it harder in those few miles? And you can always, in hindsight, you can look back and think of all of these ways you might have been able to make it more time. Like if I'd managed some faster crewing transitions or some faster.
Right.
You know, I think I lost some time just even doing things like changing into warmer gear for the night, which I hadn't even anticipated was going to be part of the plan for this. I was thinking,
right,
I'm not going to need long sleeves or anything. I'm going to be worried about staying cool. And then suddenly I'm like changing in and out of layers. And, you know, so there were various things that cut into the time buffer, but I sort of, like, thankfully, it didn't feel too, too stressful. Like, I would say most of that last section, it was, and I think I've got this, let's just make sure we don't slow down too much.
That makes sense. And I mean, you know, like you said, there's a certain amount of slowdown that's inevitable.
Yeah, you just, you know, moving at what feels like the same pace when you're 40 hours plus in. And I, you know, having done that before, I knew that was probably going to happen. So, like, I sort of tried to plan it like, okay, if things feel like they're going really, really well, maybe I could do closer to 40 hours, but I know realistically there's going to be some slowdown and those extra 4 hours are sort of there to account for that.
Right. Yeah, totally. Is there anything else you'd like to share about this experience that I haven't asked?
I mean, I guess one thing that was an interesting aspect of this was training and pursuing a project like this as a parent of a young child. So I have a 2-year-old at home. He'll be 3 in July. And so making both the training and the logistics of doing a project like this work when you have a 2-year-old at home that you're, you know, I am a full-time parent to my son. So there's, you know, even, you know, just figuring out the scheduling of training was, you know, something that it really takes some consideration. And it definitely really helped that I had a husband who was very supportive and very willing to work with me on, you know, okay, we're really going to set aside Saturdays for that's your long run day while you're training. And then also, you know, and then one evening a week that's like, you know, okay, Wednesday evenings, I can go get in a good, you know, a good 20-kilometer run in the evenings. And then everything else, other than those two blocked out times, it was kind of like trying to fit things in with a jogging stroller or hiking with my son or carrying him or fitting things in. It's like, okay, we've got an hour or two here. Maybe I can go get in a quick run. But to see, you know, both like to figure out the challenges of making that work. And also, I think it was good to see that that is something that is possible, that even though it can take a lot more scheduling and arranging and might not be as easy as life before being a parent, I think it was important to me to see that I can still be a parent and really still have lots of time with my son, but also that it's still possible to do things like this and to make that work. Because I want to share that because I know there are probably other people in that position where, you know, you want to do these big adventures and train for things like this and sort of wonder, you know, with a child at home, is this possible or how is this possible?
Right.
And so it felt good to me to know that this is something that can be done,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't mean the end of trail adventures just because you're taking care of a toddler at home too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really valuable perspective. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be able to resonate with that. So thank you for sharing that and for sharing about this adventure. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again, Anne, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastasnotime.com, and follow her adventures on Facebook at Anne Birchfield.